Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this hour of the Kids Zone here on the Radio Reading Service. This is Mark Wiesner.
And Jan Wiesner.
And today we take ourselves back into the book that we've been sharing with you for a couple days. It's called A Single Shard, a Newbery Honor Medal book. Actually, it's a great story so far. I hope you're enjoying it. It's a book written by Linda Sue Park. But before we get ourselves back into it, Jan's here to give us a little bit of a recap of where we left off.
Well, if you remember, Trier is the orphan boy that is working for Min the Potter. And Trier, because he is someone with no family, is looked down upon. And so he finds that he can be places and listen to people, and they don't pay any attention to him. And it's always been important to his survival to know when there's a wedding coming or the birth of a son or some other celebration, because that means that there will be a lot of food that he could probably have some of when they throw it away. Well, he has perfected this in that he was walking towards Min's one day, and he sees Khan, another potter, and he has his work that he's taking to the kiln really early in the morning, and it's covered. And Trier thinks that's really odd that he has covered the work. He must be trying to hide it from everyone else and getting to the kiln early enough to put his work all the way in the back of the kiln and where it won't be looked upon. And when he goes to try and see the work after it's fired, he finds that it's already been removed. So he's really curious. So he goes and he kind of hides out at Khan's, and he sees Khan walking along with two small bowls of slip. And slip is a really watered clay. And it's red and white, which is very odd because all the potters want the gray clay, which turns, when fired, makes that beautiful celadon glaze that their village is known for. So you can't imagine how he's using the red and white slip. Other potters have tried to paint on decorations with it and have found it less than successful. So now he's really on the outlook for looking at what Khan is doing and that maybe he can help Ming with it, because Ming is known to be a very expensive potter, that he's so slow that he has to charge a lot for his work, and that would be better if Ming could get a royal commission, because then that would make his work even more valuable and would allow him to have even more money. So this is what Trier is trying to look out for, to find a way to help Ming. And Ming's wife has brought Trier some clothing, and she said she had made it for their son, but he died of a fever before he ever got to wear it. It's a very warm coat and pants. And so Trier goes and gives the coat to Crane Man, the older gentleman he lives with, because it's too long and too big for him, and he keeps the trousers. And that's where we're entering back into our story.
And keep in mind, again, that the boy's name is Trier. That's spelled T-R-E-E hyphen E-A-R. Unusual name. And just so that you don't think that we're mispronouncing it, I guess. So let us begin. Flickering lamplight caught Trier's eye as he walked back to the pit from Min's one evening, snug in his new trousers. The days were so short now that he always came home in darkness. The light came from the shed behind Kang's house. Trier paused in mid-stride. A light visible from the shed with no windows. There must be a hole or a crack somewhere. The temptation was too great. Trier stole silently over the frozen ground, edged along the wall of the shed, and after a quick glance around, hunched over to put his eye to the shoulder-level knothole. With the two bowls of red and white slip before him, and an oil lamp just beyond, Kang sat in profile to Trier's view, using his wheel as a work table. He was working on a small wine cup. With an incising awl, he inscribed the leather-hard clay, a simple chrysanthemum design, far cruder than much of the elaborate incision work from which the potters of Chalupa were known. But rather than outlining the petals in the usual way, Kang was clearing away the clay to leave teardrop-shaped depressions. As Tree Ear continued to watch, Kang took up a dab of the semi-liquid white clay on the tip of the awl and deposited it into one of the petal shapes. He repeated this action for each empty space until the white petaled flower was clearly visible against the dull clay. From the stem and leaves he used the red clay. Then, with a planing tool, he carefully smoothed away the surface of the design so that the colored clay was completely level with the body of the vase itself. Kang eyed his work critically, then stood and replaced the tools on a shelf. Tree Ear realized with a start that the potter must be finished for the night and would emerge from the shed momentarily. He looked around warily and darted back to the road. Tree Ear's neck and shoulders were cramped from hunching in one position for so long. As he hurried on his way, he shrugged to loosen the stiff muscles, but he might as well have been shrugging over what he had seen.
Chapter 6. In the days that followed, Tree Ear visited the kiln every evening in an attempt to glimpse Kang's mystery wine cup after it was fired. Once he even came upon Kang's son at the kiln, removing fired vessels and loading them onto a cart. Tree Ear pretended admiration to inspect the vessels closely. They were of ordinary celadon, no sign anywhere of the strange little chrysanthemum. By snowmelt, Tree Ear had still not seen it. As he returned one evening from the kiln, he noticed several men and boys congregated about the wine shop. Every night there were a few who stopped by for a drink or two, but tonight there were so many that not all could be fit inside. The group seemed excited about something, and one of the boys hailed him. Tree Ear was surprised by the greeting. The other children of the village had long spurred him, for orphans were considered very bad luck. Children would step aside when he drew near, and the smaller ones often ducked behind their mother's skirts. Since he had begun working for men, the other potter's assistants tolerated his presence, but a friendly greeting was still a rarity. It must be important news indeed.
Tree Ear, have you heard? A royal emissary comes to Chalupa.
Tree Ear moved among the clusters of people, learning bits and pieces as he listened. With winter storms over, the sea trade routes were open again. A boat had arrived at Chalupa that afternoon. Those brought aboard carried the news that a royal emissary would be a passenger on another boat sailing in the next moon. The emissary would be bound for their village and then the district of Kangjin, a pottery region further to the south. Chalupa and Kangjin, the two destinations, could mean only one thing. The royal emissary was on a tour to assign pottery commissions for the palace. The men drank and the boys milled about, all speculating as to how many commissions would be assigned. Nervous, fearful, impassive, serene, whatever the individual's nature, hope shouted from every face of every man, though no one spoke of his desire. Tree Ear saw Kang in a corner of the wine shop, sitting with his legs outstretched and his hands behind his head. Listening, saying little, his eyes half closed, and a half-smile on his face. Kang looked like nothing so much as a man with a secret. That night, Tree Ear tossed about restlessly awake. He and Crane Man were living under the bridge again. He stared at the underside of the bridge, rolled onto his stomach, and then onto his side. Finally, Crane Man poked him.
"What demon scratches under your skin tonight?"
he asked crossly.
"It seems intent on keeping us both from slumber."
Tree Ear sat up, pulled his knees close, and wrapped his arms around them for warmth.
"A question, demon,"
he said. Cream Man sat up too.
"Well, Let us hear it then. Perhaps if the question is asked and answered, the demon will leave you in peace, and I will be able to sleep.
Tree Ear spoke slowly.
It's a question about stealing.
He paused, started to speak, stopped again, finally.
Is it stealing to take from another something that cannot be held in your hands? Ah, not a mere question, but a riddle question. At that, what is this thing that cannot be held? An idea, a way of doing something. A better way than others now use? Yes. A new way, one that could lead to great honor. Crane Man lay back down again.
He was silent for so long that Tree Ear thought he had fallen asleep. Tree Ear sighed and lay down himself, thinking, thinking. Men's work was far superior to Kang's. Everyone in Chalupo knew this, and Tree Ear had seen it for himself. Kang's work was skillful enough, his vessels well-shaped, and his glaze a fine color, but he lacked patience. Firing, the final step in the process that determined the color of the celadon, was handled well by no man. Try as potters might, the wood in the kiln never burned the same way twice. The length of time a vessel was fired, its position in the kiln, the number of other pieces fired with it, even the way the wind blew that day, 1,000 factors could affect the final color of the glaze. So when Min made a special piece, he prepared not one but several, sometimes as many as 10. Identical when they entered the kiln, they would emerge in slightly different colors. If all went well, one or two might glow with the desired translucent green. Others would be duller or less clear. Worst of all, some of the pieces had had brown spots here and there, or even an overall tinge of brown, spoiling the purity of the glaze. No one knew why this happened, so making several identical pieces was the best safeguard to ensure that at least one would fire to an unflawed celadon green. Not only was his work slow to begin with, but Min made more replicas than any other potter. Kang's pieces lacked Min's attention to detail in the making, as well as his caution in the firing. The untrained eye might see little difference between the work of the two men, but in Chalupo every eye was trained, and Tree Ear was sure the emissary's eye would be equally sharp. The palace would send only an expert, a true connoisseur, to handle the task of commissioning work. This idea of Kang's, the use of the red and white slip, could it be of such newness and beauty that it would mean a commission? If that were indeed the case, Tree Ear had no doubt that Min could use the process to far better effect. But Min did not know about it, and therein lived the question demon. If Tree Ear were to tell Min what he had seen, would that be stealing Kang's idea? Crayman's voice startled Tree Ear.
If a man is keeping an idea to himself, and that idea is taken by stealth or trickery, I say it is stealing. But once a man has revealed his idea to others, it is no longer his alone. It belongs to the world.
Tree Ear did not reply. He lay curled on one side, listening as Crane Man's breathing slowed and evened into the rhythm of sleep. An image floated out of the darkness into Tree Ear's mind, that of him himself with his eye pressed to the knothole of Kang's shed. Stealth. He could not yet tell Ming of Kang's idea.
Tree Ear's activities in the days that followed were no different than that they had been for months. Min and the other potters continued throwing pots, incising them with designs, glazing, firing, rejecting some vessels, and keeping others. But things felt different to Tree Ear, the smallest changes here and there. Min no longer sang at the wheel. His wife, normally almost invisible as she went about her household task, emerged from the house more often, sometimes to watch her husband at work for a moment, At other times, to give him a cup of tea or a rice cake, or, as he now worked right through the midday meal. At the kiln, the potter no longer joked among other themselves or smoked idly. Instead, they paced about in restless silence. All went about their work with their faces tighter, as if the news of the emissary's impending visit had pulled the string of village life taut.
By unspoken agreement, Treear joined the other potter's assistants one morning in the area between the beach and the village that served as a marketplace. They picked up debris, swept the space clear, and set up planks to display their master's wares. Treear glanced over at his colleagues. Many were setting up half a dozen planks or more. For men, only two such planks would be needed. As usual, he would have by far the fewest pieces to display. Men's instructions had been explicit. Treear was to set up the stall so that men could stand with his back to the sea and his wares before him. The emissary would thus be facing the sea when he inspected men's work. Though men did not explain, Treear knew why. It was so the emissary would see how men's vessels captured the elusive green and blue and grays of the waves. The boat docked one evening at sunset. The emissary and his entourage spent the night at the home of the local government official. Treear guessed that if those in the royal party slept that night, they were the only ones in Chalupo who did so. Long before dawn, the market space was lit by dozens of oil lamps, as potters and their assistants rushed about in an anxious, eerie silence, preparing their stalls. Treear wheeled the cart down the road from men's house, a step at a time, or so it seemed. The potter walked by his side, keeping up a constant stream of warnings and invective. "Watch that stone there to the left. Keep the cart even, stupid boy. This way. The path is smoother here. Ah, what's the matter with you? Can't you keep it from bumping for even 1 second? You will ruin my work, pighead." Men's vessels were muffled in layers and layers of tightly packed rice straw. Treear thought grimly that even if he ran at full speed, no harm would come to the work. At least his master's limited output meant that only one such trip would be necessary. At last they arrived at the makeshift stall. Men would not allow Treear to unload the cart or unpack the vessels. Instead, he was ordered to pick up every scrap of straw on the ground. Min arranged his work with great care. On the higher of the two shelves, he placed the smaller pieces. There was the little duck-shaped water dropper, and another one in the form of a lotus bud. They were flanked by three incense burners, whose basins were surmounted by animals, nearly alive in their detail: roaring lion, fierce dragon, wise tortoise. And in the center was a new set of nested boxes, inscribed with a splendid floral design. Treear had learned the answer to their mystery. Men used thin slabs of clay to build the small interior boxes first, then the larger one to fit around them. On the lower shelves, men placed two prunus vases, a tall jug ribbed like a melon, and a water pot in its matching bowl. This last piece was a special favorite of Treear's. The bow was covered with molded petals that overlapped one another and held a secret. Treear had watched his master make dozens of those petals and had finally taken a small lump of clay home in his waist pouch to practice himself. After many evenings of work, he had produced a single petal that he thought was as fine as one of men's. Now he looked at the pot, shame clashed with pride inside of him. For he had taken his petal the next day and secretly substituted it for another among those drying on men's shelf. His act had gone undetected. The stealth of it shamed him, but not enough to overcome the pride he felt at the knowledge that one of the many petals on the bow was his. And best of all, though he had examined the piece closely a dozen times, he could not tell which it was.
Min stood before the display of his wares, shaking his head and clucking with discontent. He muttered under his breath, The glaze of one piece was not as fine as it could have been. He should have made one more duck. Oh, everything was well enough, but if he had more time. As Tree Ear looked over the shelves, an idea came to him. He bowed to Min and begged his leave for a short moment. Min waved him off, hardly seeming to hear him. Tree Ear raced through the village all the way to the shrub behind Min's house. He found what he needed and hurried back, but not so quickly this time, so as to protect what he carried. Out of breath, he arrived back at the marketplace.
"Master!"
he panted, and held out his offering, two branches, a flowering plum. Tree Ear thought that Min looked pleased for the briefest instant. Then his usual cross expression returned as he took the branches.
"Yes, it would do well to show the vases as they should be used."
Min examined the branches, then handed one back to Tree Ear.
"That branch does not have enough blossoms. Why did you not bring more?"
Andy turned his back on Tree Ear to arrange the other branch in the vase on the left. Tree Ear grinned. He knew his master well enough now, and Min's response was as close as he would ever come to expressing pleasure at Tree Ear's work. There was yet one task remaining for Tree Ear before the emissary arrived, and it was not a task assigned by Min. Now that the display was complete, Tree Ear sought out Kang's stall. Every potter was busy, but a small group had still taken the time to visit Kang's display. Even from a distance, Tree Ear could sense their suppressed interest, though none there spoke beyond a word or two. Tree Ear approached as if merely passing by, but his very skin prickled with curiosity. Then a space before the stall cleared as a man stepped away, and Tree Ear saw them. Chrysanthemums, dozens of them, on every vessel, blooming from vine cups and jugs and vases and bowls, the simple eight-petaled flower caught one's attention and seized it as if they would never let go. The slight imperfections on Kang's vessels disappeared in the light that seemed to blaze from pure white blossoms. Tree Ear stepped closer. He saw that a few of the pieces had stems and leaves as well, but they were no longer brick red. In the firing, the red slip turned black, and the contrast of black and white against jade green was unmistakably new, different, remarkable, and beautiful. Even as Tree Ear turned away, feigning disinterest, as were the other potters, his heart was sinking into a bottomless well. The technique was so striking that the emissary could not help but choose Kang for a commission. Tree Ear was sure of it. Emissary Kim was a tall, thoughtful man who showed no emotion as he walked from stall to stall, inspecting the work of every potter. At some displays, he took more time. The potter's hopes rose a little higher with every second he examined their wares. He spent the longest time at Kang's stall, and the other potters gave up all pretense of indifference. They gathered around at a respectful distance as the emissary spoke with Kang. "Inlay work," Kang explained, "the same as was done to apply brass to wood, or mother-of-pearl to lacquerware." Kim nodded along with those in the little audience. Inlay work was common enough in other arts, but no one there had ever seen it used in ceramics before. Kang gave no other details of the technique, nor did the emissary request any. He merely took a great deal of time to inspect Kang's pieces thoroughly. Tree Ear felt a flicker of hope when he saw that Kim looked not only at the chrysanthemums, but at every aspect of the work. At last, he replaced the vase he was holding, and, still expressionless, moved on to the next stall. It seemed to Tree Ear that he would never reach Min's stall, yet when he did, it was all too soon. Kim immediately picked up the melon-shaped jug and looked it over with keen interest. For the first time, the planes of his face shifted with pleasure. Tree Ear could not tell.
Would this be the potter who made the wine pot used at last night's dinner?
The emissary addressed the question to Yi, the local government official at whose home he had spent the night. Yi was one of several men accompanying Kim on his inspection of the potter's work. He nodded in reply.
The melon shape is common enough now. I see it often,
Kim said. Tree Ear could hardly breathe. Did this mean that the man did not care for the piece?
And yet, this work is unmistakable,
he continued.
I knew this jug could be by no other than the same man who made the pot.
And suddenly, the expression on his face seemed pleased. Min bowed in appreciation of the compliment, and Tree Ear wondered at his master's calm. He himself had to still the glee that surged through him, lest it make him skip about, shouting. Kim took his time looking over Min's work, and finally walked on to the next display. Despite the emissary's apparent pleasure, Tree Ear knew there would be no decision that day. Kim would spend a few more days in Julepa visiting the potters whose works most interested him, perhaps stopping by the kiln sites occasionally. Then he would sail on to Kangjing. Only after he had visited both villages would he decide which potters were to receive commissions. His selections were to be announced the following month on the return visit. After the emissary's departure, Chulupa was like two villages instead of one. The potters whose work had garnered special attention, including both Min and Kang, burst into feverish activity in an effort to make one last piece that might sway a decision in their favor when Kim returned. The other potters seemed to slump as one into dejection, all but abandoning their work in favor of a long, lugubrious visits to the wine shop, where they commiserated with one another. For they knew well that the royal commissions were assigned at seemingly random intervals. Potters so chosen worked as long as their art continued to please the court. For most, a commission would last the rest of their lives. Only when a potter died or his work fell out of favor was a commission assigned. And often, the court waited until the demise of two or three potters before searching out their replacements. It could be many years before such a change came again.
Chapter 7. Min was far more irritable than usual after the emissary's visit. Instead of giving gruff, terse commands, he harangued Tree Ear at every opportunity. Then he would lasp into sullen silence that lasted until his next bout of shouting. Tree Ear worked harder than ever, tense with anticipation. Min was making vases in the melon shape that had so pleased the emissary. It seemed to Tree Ear that the potter had never before rejected so many pieces that came off the wheel. All day long, to the tune of Min's curses, he heard the sound of clay being slapped down in disgust. At last, after 2 days of abuse, Min asked the question Tree Ear had been waiting for.
So?
Min said grumpily.
Would you be telling me about it, or must I guess?
Min was the only potter who had not visited Kang's display that day. Whether genuine or feigned, his concentration was on his own work, had never wavered. But Tree Ear knew he could not have failed to notice the gathering of people, the air that had ruffled with interest around Kang's stall.
Inlay work,
Tree Ear responded at once. Crane Man's words echoed in his mind. The idea belongs to the world now, he continued.
White and red slip that fires to white and black in the finish. chrysanthemums.
Min did not reply, so Tree Ear added,
ugly ones.
For what Tree Ear guessed was the first time in Min's whole life, the potter threw back his head in a loud guffaw of laughter. He spat out, choked, cleared his throat. He looked at Tree Ear with what might have been almost affection.
Ugly ones, you say? Well, of course. What else could Kang do, that bumble-fingered excuse for a potter?
Suddenly, he clapped his hands once and snapped.
Go, then. White and red clay, drained, as for glaze.
Tree Ear jumped to his feet almost before Min had finished speaking. He was flying down the road with the cart, carrying crazily before him. Days before, Tree Ear had mapped out the best places along the river for colored clay, and now he went directly to the first spot. He dug and loaded, his excitement kept in check by the rhythm of the work. The spade had never felt so light as it did that day. Over the next several days, Min sketched what seemed like hundreds of designs. His wife helped by drawing the basic melon shape over and over in charcoal on pieces of wood. Min would add his ideas for the inlay design, reject them angrily, and hand the wood back to her to be wiped and reused. Meanwhile, Tree Ear was busy draining the clay. Twice, three times, four, and the fifth time with the white clay, something happened. Tree Ear was rubbing the sediment between his fingers as he always did. Suddenly, his fingertips tingled with a strange feeling. For some odd reason, he thought of a time when he had been on the mountainside, taking a break as he chopped wood. He had been staring into the forest greenery when a deer appeared in abrupt focus. It had been there all along, and he had been looking straight at it, but only at the last moment had he actually seen it. It was now the same, only instead of seeing with his eyes, he was feeling with his hands. The clay felt good, fine, pliant, smooth, but not ready yet. Tree Ear froze, completely still except for the tips of his fingers in the clay. What was it that made him think so? His mind could not find the right words. The clay had long since lost any feeling of roughness, but somehow he knew. One more draining, perhaps two. It was like suddenly seeing the deer, a clear vision emerging from a cloudy stream. And it was as if he awoke from that dream as he drained the clay yet again, a dream in which the words to describe exactly how he knew about the clay would be held forever secret.
Having finally selected a design, Min began incising it. This was the most detailed part of the work, and he disliked anyone watching. As Tree Ear swept the yard or brought clay to and from the draining site, he tried to catch a glimpse of what he could. It was always so when Min was incising. Now the Tree Ear knew well every aspect of Min's work. He loved seeing the incision work emerge even more than he had once loved watching the vessels grow on the wheel. Min used sharp tools with points of various sizes. The outline of the design was first sketched lightly into the leather-hard clay with the finest point. Then Min would carve out the design a bit at a time. Unlike other potters who traced a complete pattern with their initial incisions, Min sometimes varied from the sketchy tracing. His work seemed to flow more freely, both in the making and in the final results. The glaze would collect in the crevices of the design, making it slightly darker than the rest of the surface. Once the piece was fired, the pattern would be so subtle as to be almost invisible in some kinds of light. Min's incision work was meant to provide a second layer of interest, another pleasure for the eye, without detracting in the least from the grace of the shape and wonder of color that were the piece's first claims to beauty. Min was inscribing lotus blossoms and peonies between the ribbed lines of one of the melon vases. At the end of each day, Tree Ear always tried to check Min's shelves to see what progress had been made. Because Min was now attempting inlay work rather than merely incision, some of the petals and leaf spaces were carved out into little depressions. But Tree Ear could already see how much finer and more detailed Min's work was than Kang's. The blossoms had many more petals, each beautifully shaped, the stems and leaves twined and feathered as if alive. Tree Ear exulted silently over his master's work. He could hardly wait to see the pieces after they were fired. Surely the emissary would see that Min's work could both honor tradition and welcome the new in a way that was worthy of a commission.
Min came to the draining site after a few days to check on Tree Ear's work. Because only small amounts were needed, Tree Ear was working with the red and white clay in bowls instead of in the pits. Min closed his eyes as he touched his fingertips to the contents of the bowl. After a brief instant, he opened his eyes and sniffed.
"You took too long,"
he said dismissively. He walked back to the house carrying both bowls. Tree Ear pressed his lips together so as not to grin too widely at the potter's departing back. It was the first time he had prepared the clay to such a fine finish without further prompting from Min. Min made 5 replicas of the melon-shaped vase. To inscribe the design and then inlay each part of it with the colored slip was the work of countless hours, and Tree Ear remained at the house until well after dark to assist Min however he could. After a vase had been inscribed and inlaid, Min removed every bit of excess slip. Finally, the vases were dipped in glaze. Never had Tree Ear taken such care over the draining, and Min himself had done the final drainings and mixing of the glaze. Min was like a man with a demon inside him. He ate little, slept less, and whether he worked by daylight or lamplight, his eyes always seemed to glitter with ferocity. Tree Ear felt that the very air in the workspace under the eaves was alive with whispers and hisses of anxiety. The emissary would be returning very soon. At last, the day came when they would load the vases into the kiln. Each vase was placed carefully on 3 seashells set in a triangle atop one of the clay shelves, in a position near the middle of the kiln, where Min determined it would fire best. Then the wood was precisely arranged in complicated crisscross patterns of many layers. The kindling of twigs and pine needles was lit with a spark from a flint stone, and when the fire was well on its way, the door of the kiln was sealed. The heat in the kiln was extremely difficult to control. The kiln had to heat up slowly. Too rapid a rise in temperature at the start, and the vessels would crack. This warming process took a full day. Beginning on the second day, more wood was added from time to time through openings in the kiln walls. On the 3rd or 4th day, when a potter hoped that the correct temperature had been reached, the openings were sealed with clay plugs. The fire blazed at its hottest then, until it had eaten all the air within the kiln and began to die. And it took 2 or 3 days for the kiln to cool down. Min preferred to fire his replicas in at least 2 different batches whenever possible. But with the emissary's return nearly at hand, there was time for only 1 firing. When Min always stayed at the kiln during the crucial first stages of warming and adding more fuel, he usually went home after the openings had been sealed. This time, however, he remained at the site for the entire period of the firing. Tree Ear laid armfuls of straw on the hillside, and there Min sat, the hollows under his eyes dark with exhaustion. His orders were curt as usual, but quiet. Tree Ear could hardly believe it. He would almost rather have Min shouting at him. The quiet was alarming. Tree Ear brought food from the house, but Min left most of us untouched. He sent Tree Ear back and forth between the house and the kiln on various errands. At the end of each day, Tree Ear crept away on tiptoe, as if any noise might disrupt Min's concentration and somehow ruin the firing. Tree Ear had never figured out if it was his footfalls that woke Crane Man, or if Crane Man simply did not sleep until Tree Ear came home. But no matter how late it was, his friend never failed to greet him when he arrived under the bridge, nor was his voice ever weighed down with sleep. 3 years' long hours of work for men left the two friends no time for light for walks or other activities. Instead, Crane Man had taken to telling stories. He had often told folk tales of foolish donkeys or brave tigers when Trier was a youngster. But that had been many years ago, and Trier welcomed the chance to hear the old yarns again. There were new ones, too, sagas about the heroes and heroines of Korea. The stories were a much-needed distraction. After listening to Crane Man's voice for a while, Trier was able to relax and fall into a dreamless sleep. On the last day, men told Trier to spend the afternoon at the house tidying the yard. He was returned to the site after sundown. The pieces would be removed from the kiln under cover of darkness. A misted half moon had risen to the height of its arc by the time Trier had swept the kiln entrance clear of ashes. Holding a lamp, he stood beside as men crawled in. Men used a pair of special wooden tongs to carry out the still-hot vases one by one and place them carefully into the cart where Trier had prepared a bed of straw. The moon did not give enough light for Trier to see clearly, but when the last vase had been removed, Trier crawled back into the kiln to fetch the lamp. The flame in the small lamp flickered treacherously. It was difficult to inspect the vases closely. The inlay work stood out even in the deceptive light. But Min sighed and shook his head. They would have to wait until morning to see the results. Together they packed more straw between the vases. Then Min held the lamp while Trier cautiously rode the cart down to the house. The night quiet except for the single-minded singing of the frogs by the river and once the plaintive call of a nightbird.
You are late tonight, my friend,
Crane Man called, lighting the lamp as Tree Ear slid down the embankment.
Unloading the kiln,
Tree Ear replied.
I'm sorry you had to wait so long for your supper.
Crane Man waved his crutch, as if brushing away the apology.
I eat too well these days, fat and lazy, that's what I've become,
he joked. Tree Ear should have been nearly dead with fatigue, but he was too tense to lie down. Instead, he sat up and watched his friend eat. As the light flickered around the little den formed by the bridge overhead and the riverbank walls, Tree Ear suddenly had the sense of seeing clearly the things that had always been there, like the deer with his eyes or the clay with his fingers. The few cooking pots and bowls were stacked on a little shelf formed by the rocks, with chopsticks, a single spoon, and Crane Man's knife in a neat row. Tree Ear's sleeping mat was rolled up and set to one side. There were two baskets Crane Man had woven. One held a few wild mushrooms, the other bits and pieces that might come in handy one day, scraps of cloth, twine, flint stone. Everything was so familiar to Tree Ear. Crane Man, having lived under the bridge for so many years, it must be nearly invisible to him by now. Tree Ear spoke almost before he thought.
Crane Man, how is it that when you lost your home and your family, you did not go to the temple?
Those with nowhere else to go always went to the temple. The monks took them in, fed them, gave them work to do. Eventually, many of them became monks themselves. This would have been the usual course for someone who met with misfortune as Crane Man had, and Tree Ear wondered why he had never asked the question before. Crane Man looked almost displeased for an instant, then his lips curled into a sheepish smile.
Ah, there's a reason, but it's a foolish one, and would become more so in the telling.
Tree Ear waited. Crane Man said at last,
it is a worse foolishness to do something foolish and then to be unable to laugh at it later. A fox, then. It was a fox that kept me from the temple.
A fox?
Foxes were dreaded animals. They were not large or fierce like the bears and tigers that roamed the mountains, but they were known to be fiendishly clever. Some people even believed that foxes possessed evil magic. It was said that a fox could lure a man to his doom, tricking him into coming to its den, where somehow he would be fed to its offspring. Even to say the word made a trickle of fear run down Tree Ear's spine.
The house had been sold,
Crane Man said.
I gathered up my belongings and made ready to go to the temple. It was a fine day. I remember, and I made a long time of it, walking up the mountainside. So it was dusk, and I was still a good distance away. Suddenly a fox appeared before me. It stopped there, right in the middle of the path, grinning with all its teeth shining white, licking its lips, its eyes glowing, its broad tail swishing back and forth slowly, back and forth. Enough!
Tree Ear's eyes were wide with horror.
What happened?
Crane Marin picked up the last morsel of rice with his chopsticks, and he popped it into his mouth.
Nothing,
he said.
I have come to believe that foxes could not possibly be as clever as we think them. There I was, close enough to touch one, with a bad leg as well, and here I am still today. But that night, of course, I could not continue on my journey. I walked all the way down the mountain again, looking over my shoulder nearly the whole time. The fox did not follow me. Indeed, it disappeared as quickly as it had come. That night I stayed under the bridge, although you can be sure I found no sleep. It was many days before I could even think about making the journey again, and by that time this...
Crane Man waved his chopsticks at the little space.
Had begun to seem like home. Days became months. Months grew into years. Then you came along.
Crane Man smiled as he finished his story.
Between the fox and you, I was destined never to become a monk.
Tree Ear unrolled his sleeping mat and lay down. But a few moments later, he rose to his knees and peered at the darkness beyond the bridge. Were those two eyes glowing, or just reflections of starlight on the river? As always, Crane Man seemed to know what Tree Ear was doing, even in the dark.
Go to sleep,
he ordered, sounding almost like men.
Or are you trying to make me feel an even bigger fool for planting foolishness in you?
Tree Ear shook his head, smiling, and settled down at last. To Tree Ear's surprise, Min's wife was waiting for him out on the road in front of the house the next morning. Beside her were the cart and spade. Although her face was as placid and kind as always, Tree Ear saw in her eyes some great worry that even her gentle smile of greeting could not hide.
More clay, Tree Ear,
she said quietly.
Both plain and colored.
Tree Ear bowed in reply, and she turned back to the house. He trotted down the road a few paces until he was sure she had gone inside. Then he left the cart by the side of the road and crept around to the back of the house. Tree Ear felt the blood drain from his face at the terrible sight that greeted his eyes. The yard was covered with pieces of shattered pottery, hundreds of them, it seemed. Tree Ear knew at once what had happened. The face of Min's wife had told him. She was neither angry nor fearful. Instead, she had seemed deeply, quietly, sad. It could mean only one thing. Min had smashed the vases himself. Tree Ear counted on his fingers 5 piles of shards, all 5 of the melon-shaped vases. One of them had been hurled so far the pieces of it lay just a few paces short of where he stood, peeping from behind the corner of the house. Tree Ear glanced about quickly, then tiptoed a few steps into the yard and gathered up some of the larger pieces. He tucked them hastily into his waist pouch and darted back to the cart. At the riverbank, Tree Ear lowered the cart handles and reached inside his waist pouch for the shards of pottery. The inlay work was flawless, the floral design intricate and graceful, even on the incomplete pieces he held. But the glaze, Tree Ear frowned and squinted. The dreaded brown tint suffused the glaze of every piece. Some of them were marred with brown spots as well. They were fragments of the same vase, but the destruction of all five meant that every vase was flawed. Min had done the mixing of the glaze himself, so the mistake could only have been in the firing, the part of the work over which not even Min had complete control. Tree Ear gripped the shards tightly. He cried out as he flung them into the river, not even noticing that one of them had cut his palm. There was no time left. Even now, the emissary's boat might be in the harbor.
Chapter 8. Min began work on another set of inlaid vases. But before the throwing was complete, the emissary's ship docked. Emissary Kim sent a messenger to ask if any of the potters had anything new to show. Min waved the messenger away without a word. The next morning, the news blew through the village like a sudden sea breeze. The emissary had visited Kong's house. Kong had been chosen for a commission. Later that morning, Tree Ear swept up the remains of the destroyed vases in Min's yard. It was as he had guessed. All the pieces bore traces of brown, clouded glaze. Tree Ear felt numb with disappointment. He wondered how much worse it must be for Min. The potter had still not come out of the house with instructions for the day, so Tree Ear turned to the vegetable patch. He squatted down and began to pull first of 1,000 noxious shoots that threatened the cucumber plants so precious to Min's wife. Someone called out from the front of the house. Tree Ear recognized the voice of the government official Yi.
Potter Min, the emissary is here. He wishes to speak with you.
Tree Ear dropped the ragged weed he was holding and stole around to the window at the side of the house. He could see little but heard everything. Min welcomed Yi, Emissary Kim, and the men of the royal cortege into his house. They sat around a low table in silence. Tree Ear heard the clink of pottery as Min's wife served tea. Then Emissary Kim began to speak.
This inlay work of your colleagues, it is something new and will be of great interest to the court.
There was a pause. Tree Ear imagined Min nodding in polite agreement.
I will speak with no veil over my thoughts, Potter Min. Other aspects of Potter Kang's works are, how can I say it, not as much to my taste. Kang has been given what I will call a limited commission. He will produce work for the court for a year to see if it pleases His Majesty.
Kim hesitated, then continued.
I would far rather have you be given the honor of a royal commission, but I would be remiss in my responsibilities if I were to ignore this new technique. It must be presented to the court. I will now return to Sando. But if you were to produce something using this inlay style and bring it to me in Songlo, I would guarantee a careful consideration of the work.
Tree Ear could barely contain his excitement. The shards, he wanted to shout. Show him the pieces from the rubbish heap. He's an expert. He'll understand about the firing. But Min was speaking now.
The royal emissary honors me with his words, and I wish to disappoint no one. But I am an old man now. I could not possibly make the journey to Songdo. I thank the emissary for his consideration and beg his understanding for my failure.
Tree Ear heard the swish of fine, heavy fabric as the emissary rose to his feet and went to the door. The emissary spoke once more.
It is my wish that you find a way somehow, Potter Min. It would be a great sorrow to me if this were to be the last time I saw your fine work.
Then he and his entourage were gone. Tree Ear turned and slid down the wall, slumped over with his head in his hands. The old fool, he thought. He does not wish the emissary to see the imperfect glaze. His pride keeps him from a royal commission. The fool! Just then, Min's wife came around the house with a basket of laundry. Tree-Ear jumped to his feet to help her. She nodded her thanks, calm as ever, as if the tumultuous events of the past few days had never happened. They stood on either side of the clothesline. He handed her the garments, and she hung them. Her serenity and the rhythm of the task helped soothe Tree-Ear's raw nerves. Yet again he wished he could think of a way to show his gratitude for her kindness. What was it she wanted, he wondered. She seemed to have no desire of her own, or perhaps her wishes were those of her husband's. Suddenly an answer came to Tree-Ear as if calling from the clear sky. Doing Min a favor, a great favor, that was the way to thank her. Her husband's success, that was what she desired. Before he could think about it any longer, he heard himself speaking.
I have a request to make of the Honorable Potter's wife,
he said.
Please?
She replied.
I am aware of the generous offer made by the royal emissary.
He confessed and glanced quickly at her. Her eyes crinkled in amusement, so he knew she did not mind that he had eavesdropped.
If the master would make a vessel he considers worthy of the court's attention, it would be my greatest honor to be allowed to take it to Sandu for him.
Her face was partially hidden behind the linen sheet she was hanging. She fixed it firmly to the line before she answered.
I will ask the master under one condition,
she said.
No, two conditions. The first is that you return to Chalupa quickly and safely.
Tree-Ear bowed, puzzled. Why should it matter to her how he journeyed?
And the second?
She paused.
The second is that from now on, you will call me Ajimba.
Tree-Ear's eyes filled with tears. He bent to pick up another piece of laundry. Ajimba meant something like auntie. It was a term of great affection, reserved only for older kinswoman. Tree-Ear was kin to no one, and yet Min's wife wished for him to call her Ajimba. He did not even know if he could say the word.
Well, Tree-Ear?
The gentle teasing had returned to her voice.
Do you agree to my conditions?
Tree-Ear nodded. He spoke from behind the clothes that flapped on the line.
I agree,
he said, and then faltered. His voice fell to a whisper.
I agree, Ajimba.
A few days later,
we're going to have to bring this hour to a close. It's a pleasure to be with you each Saturday afternoon. This has been Mark Wiesner.
And Jan Wiesner.
And we wish you a great week ahead.
Bye-bye.
Take care.